Broadcast out of New York City, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health on the Progressive Radio Network on Monday, December 31st, 2012. I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. Happy New Year!
Indeed.
And thank you for joining us on our weekly Prescriptions for Health show on the Progressive Radio Network every Monday live from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and from 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. And remember, our shows are available 24/7 on PRN.fm.
We'll be talking about what's new in the news in health, and you will hear Vicki's 2020 health tips at 20 after and 20 to the hour. And we've got another great show for you today that's going to include, are mass murders preventable?
And should MDs prescribe cognitive enhancers?
Do MDs do too many pelvic exams?
And how profound are medical school conflicts of interest?
And do oncologists make a profit on the chemotherapy they prescribed?
Well, this whole thing with the Newtown, Connecticut massacre was pretty horrible. And anybody who's lost a child says that it's the worst pain of all. And it's not the planned order of things, because parents are supposed to die before their children. And to think of 20 children just plowed down by a mass murderer is just so horrific that it's pretty hard to comprehend. And the Newtown, Connecticut massacre has shaken America. We must prevent incomprehensible, horrendous acts like this from happening again in the future. So what's the answer? I mean, where do we even start? Everybody's talking about gun control.
Well, gun control is part of it. There's no question. I mean, we don't all need AK-47s. And where do you stop it? With grenades? How about with a tank? How about with a Scud missile?
Or a bomb.
Yeah. Where do you stop with that? How much of a right do we have? And at the other end of it, I mean, if we have people who are out there who are using guns that shouldn't have them, then we wind up with these massacres that happen that are just unacceptable.
Well, there's a time and a place for a gun, you know, and when the gun is in the hands of the wrong person, you know, that's when we've got trouble.
So how do we solve that? We need to identify those people so that we can be sure that they're not going to have guns. And that can be done, and we'll talk about that.
Yeah, because that could be a little bit tricky. Some people think nutrition has something to do with it, anger management, and maybe even brain dysfunction testing. Some of these people don't have the feelings of empathy. And obviously, the person that shot all those children and those six teachers didn't have any feelings of empathy. Media control, you know, the media makes these people out to be heroes in a lot of ways. They play them up so much and give them so much attention that other people that are that way thought.
If you talk about publicity making him a hero, I guess that's true. But I don't think anybody's looking at them as a hero of any
kind. No, but the other people that are that way.
Are disturbed, right.
They look at it
like they're heroes. Oh, that's the copycat system. That's right.
Then bullying fits into this and abuse. And then education also plays a role.
Well, what we have here is a problem with gun control for sure. We need a mental health system that actually takes care of people, and we don't have that. What's happened is our asylums have become jails. Back in about 1970 or thereabouts, 1980, when Governor Reagan was the governor of California, a lot of the mental health systems that we had were just shut down. And now we've got our jails full of people who are mentally ill.
He thought we couldn't afford to have these state hospitals, but I think maybe we can't afford not to have them.
Well, that's right. And so we need a system that teaches people what they need to know so that they can identify people. And we have to be able to have a system that takes care of them and also protects society. That's the real problem. So when we're looking at people who are abused in some way or who have genetic tendencies to be abnormal or a post-traumatic stress syndrome, we need to be able to identify those people and either help them or take them out of society.
How do we identify them, though?
Well, that's a problem. I mean, we usually identify them after they do something, and then we all get upset about what they've done because they've murdered a bunch of people, and that's obviously too late. But we have to be able to have a system that will make it easy for us to see that these people are disturbed. One of the things that we could do is certainly we could do something to have a system in our educational system where kids who have challenges in their life can get together in a course that's mandatory that everybody takes. and they interact with each other. And usually in a setting like that, these people will identify themselves because a lot of the time they like to brag and talk about what they think they're going to do. And they think they have a sense of righteousness in being able to do that, as crazy as it sounds.
And the people that hear this have a responsibility to report it to somebody.
Well, the silence of third parties is a big deal. And I think those people, I mean, you could look at a mother who's got a problem. We looked at one story that you showed me about a boy named Michael, which is a made-up name. And his mother had four kids, and one of them turned out to be this person who was going to be a mass murderer. And he would be wonderfully pleasant most of the time, but he'd go off the deep end at times as well.
He would just go absolutely ballistic. But the main thing was, is she said that no one will pay attention unless you've got charges against him. So she had to get him charged with a crime. And it seems weird that you could charge a child with a crime.
Well, I mean, kids definitely do things that are criminal. And we have juvenile places where, you know, juvenile jails where kids go. But a lot of these kids have problems that are emotional, that are the result of what I call post-traumatic stress syndrome. They live in dysfunctional families, and they're bullied, and they're having problems with their peers, and they hate to be judged, and they have these attacks of stress.
Well, maybe they're just playing mentally disturbed.
Well, they are. There's no question they are. So you're going to put somebody like that in jail? Now, they should be removed from society because we can't have them out there. And we can't have mass murders going on. That's unacceptable. And up to this time, nobody's come up with a solution. All we do is we complain about it and say it's terrible.
You know, I remember seeing a show once about some kid that was having these horrible temper tantrums, and it turned out that the cause of it was from artificial colors.
Oh, well, that's a little bit much. I mean, that can happen, and we have examples of things like that.
But this woman says that they still don't know what's wrong with her son. She says they've thought of autism spectrum and ADHD and oppositional defiant or intermittent explosive disorder.
Whatever you call it doesn't really matter. What matters is that the child is not controllable at times, and he's very smart
and
has the potential, I mean, and is threatened to kill. I mean, what do you do with somebody like that? You put them in jail in today's society unless you happen to have a lot of money that you can afford private
psychiatrists. Well, the problem is that many parents are very protective, though, you see.
Sure, yeah.
I'm imagining that Adam Lanza's mother was probably protective. I mean, if nobody knew anything about him that way, he was just this quiet, reclusive person.
Well, that's right.
And nobody knows what set him off, but there were guns in the house, and she had taught him how to use the guns. And so there's just so much that we don't know about that.
So where do we go?
This is why people think that we shouldn't have guns.
Well, I mean, look what's happened throughout history. We have to have guns. And I think that we can't deny the people of the United States being able to arm themselves.
Well,
that's our Constitution. It's our Second Amendment that says we have the right to bear arms. And look at the countries that did have gun control back in 1929, the Soviet Union. Established gun control, and from 29 to 53, about 20 million people there were unable to defend themselves. And how about Turkey in 1911? They established gun control, and about 1.5 million Armenians couldn't defend themselves, and they were rounded up and exterminated. The same thing happened in Germany during World War II with the Jews, 13 million Jews. It happened in China, in Guatemala, in Uganda, in Cambodia.
You've got to have
The right to be able to bear arms to defend yourself. And it's not like you're going to do a great job of defending yourself when you've got the military with Scud missiles and, you know, airplanes and bombs that are horrific. But you're going to be able to do something different than if you're not armed. So we have that right. But what do you need? And how can you protect people from having those guns get in the hands of those that are disturbed?
Well, sometimes people don't seem like they're disturbed, and then they go through something, you know, like you were talking post-traumatic stress, but maybe they go through a divorce, or they lose a huge amount of money, or they're fired from their job, and they're lacking social skills, and so they become like this human volcano,
exactly.
And they just explode, and they just go ballistic and start killing everybody, and they're upset, so they want everybody to go down with them.
Well, that's unfortunately
true, too. They're upset,
too.
So they want everybody else to be upset.
All right, well, then you can look at countries that have gun control that's really substantial, and we find that the U.S. homicide rate is 30 times that of the U.K., and in Australia, it's 10 times as high, and in India, it's four times as as low. So there's much less violence where there's less in the way of guns. But you've got this other side that says, well, what about my Second Amendment rights? I have the right for all that.
You know, if you take away everybody's guns,
yeah,
the ones that are still going to be able to have them are probably going to be the bad people.
Well, a lot of them, plus the military
because
and the police.
Because they'll smuggle them or whatever they'll do, and they'll find ways to get them.
Well,
and
that's
then
right.
The innocent people don't have anything to defend themselves.
Well, that's right.
It needs to start somewhere else, and maybe it should start in school. You know, there's so much emphasis in school about academics, and maybe we need to put a little bit more emphasis on what a person's purpose is, and what a person's purpose is in life and so forth. Now, some of that's taught in church, but, you know, God's not supposed to even be in the schools now, you know.
Well, that's another thing of the separation of state and
church.
And church, as it should be. Well, we need to be able to identify deranged people, that's for sure. And we need psychological services to be able to protect society and to help people who are disturbed. It's not enough just to be outraged, which is what happens every time there's a mass murder, and then to wonder what we could have done to prevent it. But we fail to implement specific proactive measures, and so we wind up with more mass murders. So academic achievement's important, but so is the rest of life. How do you get along with people in your community? How do you feel like, are you a part of it? How do you get rid of the challenges, the dysfunctional challenges that we face as we go through life? From our parents and other people who are our role models that are not doing the best job they could, or from people who are bullying you in school, or lots of other things that can make life really tough for you. How do you protect against that?
I was even reading an article that sometimes it's caused from head trauma.
Absolutely.
Like kids might beat up their siblings, and they don't tell the parents that they hit them in the head or whatever.
Well,
and then they end up with all these dysfunctional behaviors.
Well, look at people who are on the streets of San Francisco, you know, where we are. The homeless people. You do brain scans on them, functional MRIs and SPECT scans. It's a disaster how bad they are. And what do? They're
just
still on the streets.
Leave them in the street.
They're still on the streets. Where's the medical care for them? And how do you help straighten out them? And a lot of those people are who? People who have post-traumatic stress from being in previous wars. The VA system doesn't cover it as well as it should. So what we have is a terrible problem that we haven't resolved, but that we could resolve. You know, we say we don't have the money to pay for the services that we need for good mental health or for our schools to be able to have classes like this. Well, what could be more important than making sure that tomorrow's citizenry is physically, mentally, emotionally, and spiritually healthy? We need to be able to be at peace and to love and to be protected from mass murders and for people who have violence.
I think also that people need to be taught that it's okay to so-called tattle. You know, it's okay to tell, because the other thing is parents, many times they think that their role is to protect their child, and they feel like they would be a bad parent if they told on their child. But they want to protect the child, but that's not protecting the child. They need to protect the child from themselves, and they need to protect themselves from their child and as well as society. But also friends, maybe if these people have like one friend or somebody that they've told it to, like you were mentioning earlier, in a group or something. Those people need to know that it's okay to tell. If they tell, then they're a hero. It's not the other way around, that they're a hero for being loyal to the person that's planning some horrendous deed.
Yeah, well, I mean, we need to have ways of finding out what the truth is. And a lot of this is about how do you bring the truth forward. So if we had classes that started from kindergarten on, right through every level of education, including advanced postgraduate education, where how you lived your life and what life's all about, what its meaning is, should be part of that educational system. Otherwise, we wind up with a bunch of people who have ability to do rocket science and to do higher math and to be brilliant at whatever they do.
Figure out how to make bombs and guns on their own.
Well, some of them do.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the problem. And so we need to know who our brothers and sisters are and be able to look at what's happening in their lives, to identify that they have problems, and then do something to evaluate them so they can either have treatment or they can be removed from society, because we simply can't have automatic weapons in the hands of people who are deranged and capable of doing violent acts like mass murders.
And we need to have more emphasis on goodness and ethics and morals and doing things together and supporting one another and
right.
not bullying.
Exactly. Well, these are the values that should be taught in school. Those, of course, are the values that should be taught by every parent to every child, starting from the time they're born.
But
that
doesn't happen. There's a lot of dysfunction.
Well, I mean, it's more dangerous to live in a city like Atlanta than it is to be in Iraq, okay, when we had the war, because there are so many deaths that are occurring in our big cities. Violence is a way that a lot of people express themselves because they get so frustrated with what the system is like that they're not going to take it anymore. And I like this idea of what President Obama is doing by trying to help the poor people and people who are in the middle class to give them more rights. But on the flip side of that, what happens is we have more of a tendency towards one size fits all in a socialistic state, or even more worse, like a dictatorship. And those two are frightening things that we have to protect ourselves. So on the one hand, we have to have guns. We have the right to bear arms, and we should do that, and we should know how to use them. But on the other hand, we have to have a system that's compassionate and caring and is going to be able to take care of people who are deranged. We have to identify them and then protect people so that they don't go out killing us.
Yeah, it's not like the old movies, the cowboys and Indians, where everybody's shooting everybody, and it's getting like that in certain places like Oakland even.
Well, I mean, it's all over the country. Violence is the way we deal with things all too often. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. It's time for a short Prescriptions for Health break. And Nurse Vicki's first 2020 tip on USDA specifications for cage-free and free-range. And then we'll be right back with, should MDs prescribe cognitive enhancers? Like Adderall, Concerta, and Ritalin. So stay tuned.
Shop in the health food stores, terms like cage-free and free-range and grass-fed and pasture-raised eggs come up. And I want to talk about what the USDA specifications are for cage-free, for example. That's a flock that's able to roam with unlimited access to food and fresh water, but it doesn't require access to out-of-doors, so they can walk around and eat. And the food that they feed them isn't so great. So just because they're cage-free doesn't mean that they're really healthy. I mean, chickens, commercial standard chicken feed is grain, soy, corn, a lot of other kind of grains and things. And slaughtered chickens like and ground animal byproducts, feces, plastic, additives, antibiotics, and growth hormones that increase your blood vessel growth, like angiogenesis, which increases our risks of cancer. They even put arsenic with antibiotics because they want pinker chickens with bigger breasts. And some of the other countries also give growth hormones. Now, free range is a flock that's provided shelter with unlimited access to food and fresh water also. And they have continuous access to out-of-doors, but it may be fenced in or in an area covered with netting, and they may never be able to even get outside, even if they have access, because they can't get through the other chickens. So that's free range.
Free if you can get it.
Now, the FDA doesn't have a labeling policy yet for pasture-raised and grass-fed. So what these are is they're left to roam, and they can eat the grass and the insects, and they supplement them with grain. So unless they're organic, they can be subject to environmental pollutants, and the supplemental grain that they give them can be GMO and have other things in it, like I just mentioned about the ingredients in the chicken feed. So grass-fed is important because they get grass and they get insects and they get sunshine in a pasture, you know, in a pasture-raised system to ensure vital fat-soluble vitamins like A and D and K2 in the eggs and in the meat, and it protects the chickens and the consumer from pathogens that are associated with improper diet and crowding and concentrated manure and no sun and all that kind of thing. So we need to ask if it's organic because we don't want the grass sprayed with the pesticides. We don't want our chickens eating pesticide sprayed worms.
That's right. What they eat, we eat, and we got the same thing, right?
The other thing just to note is salmonella is so unusual. You don't really have to worry about salmonella.
Not most of the time, that's right.
Yeah.
Particularly with organic, that's right.
Yeah, so the best way to go is the grass-fed, pasture-raised organic.
Okay, that's great information.
Yeah. Okay, now we were going to talk about cognitive enhancers. Cognitive enhancers are prescription stimulants like Concerta, we hear on TV all the time, and Ritalin and Adderall, used to treat ADD and ADHD. And they're often used by healthy people to enhance their concentration and their memory and their alertness and their mood. So is this really smart to take these pharmaceutical drugs to get good grades? Are they safe? And especially, this is important to think about because 11% of college students
up to 11% yeah.
take these cognitive enhancers so that they are hoping to get better grades. And also high school students and middle school students are doing this now.
For that plus recreational use, that's right.
Because
it's like speed. It's a small version of speed. And fortunately, the people up in Canada published an article in the Canadian Medical Association Journal in December of 2012. That showed that they didn't think it was a good idea either, and they came out and just said it. And they think that these stimulants should be restricted to people who have ADD or other kinds of problems. But when you're talking about trying to just enhance concentration so that you have better memory, alertness, and mood is really not a smart thing to do because there are side effects to these drugs that can be terrible.
And aren't there safer ways to do it?
Well, I mean, do we really want to drive our kids insane with grades? Is it all about star testing? Or is it something about trying to get an education where you can – I mean, how many things do you remember from college, Vicki? I remember almost nothing from college. I got a few concepts from it. It taught me how to think more than anything else. And it wasn't about grades. It was a big thing for me anyway. I never thought that grades were that important. And I think that there are many other things that are far more important than that, like how to live your life, know why you're here and what kinds of things should you be involved with that are going to make you happy. That's what education should be about.
So when a child is not manageable, they give them these drugs and they label them as having ADD or
yeah.
ADHD.
Right.
And if they're not doing well in school, they give them the drugs so they can do better in school.
I mean, these kids
just giving them a healthy diet and getting enough sleep, that'll help your concentration.
Well, you're right.
Reducing stress so you're not thinking about all these other things that get your attention, you know, in your mind because your mind's off
sure.
wandering about what your problems
and
are.
And make it interesting.
And how about exercising? That's good, too. That
sure.
gets your brain working better. Those things are healthy.
Look at the Waldorf schools. What do they do? I mean, they're out there allowing the child to learn what they want to learn at the time that they're interested in it, rather than saying you're going to go to school for these hours and these are the classes you're going to take and that's it.
But as far as nutrition goes, essential fatty acids are really, really healthy for the brain, and those help, too. So why don't they try a healthy lifestyle first?
That's too simple, Vicki.
And then doesn't work, maybe think about it. But gosh, I mean, to get good grades, you got to study.
You know, well, you do to a point. That's right. And it should be interesting enough that you're there focused on something with intensity.
But
skill of a teacher.
And is it worth it to become addicted or to get heart rhythm disturbances or even psychosis can be a side effect
of
this?
Well, and seizure disorders. I mean, all these things are big issues. I know I have a patient now who's in his 60s who I can't get off the Adderall that he's been on for 40 years or 50 years. You know, ever since he was a kid and they said you have ADD, which I don't think he ever did. But now he's addicted to it. And the minute I try to take him off of his Adderall, he says, I can't function. I'm just flat. I have no energy. It's like I'm depressed. I say, I know. That's what happens when you take it a long time. Plus, he developed atrial fibrillation, okay, from the Adderall as well. And at the time, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, maybe a little longer than that, the electrophysiologist who was his doctor for atrial fibrillation said, oh, no, there's no relationship between the Adderall and that, but there sure as heck was.
Oh, right.
And there's a lot of information that's out in the publications now that all of a sudden it's true because somebody did a study and showed it. But common sense will tell you, revving people up is not the right answer.
And, you know, to me, this seems like it falls into a category of cheating. You know, you're cheating yourself, you're cheating your life, you're cheating your mind and your health, and you're also trying to take something so that you can get a better grade than somebody else.
Well, it shouldn't be about competition. It should be about community. It should be about studying things that you like to learn about, and our teachers should be doing that.
Well, some of the things they could be teaching them is meditation, too.
A lot of things that they
should
be teaching.
How to deal with their stress and their focus in life and so forth.
All right, it's time for a network station break. You're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki. And when we come back, we'll be talking about, do MDs do too many pelvic exams? So stay tuned for more Prescriptions for Health Radio. Welcome back to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Sabuda here with Nurse Vicki.
Women don't usually look forward to their annual pelvic exam.
I'll say.
So, ladies, the good news is that they're no longer recommended by the United States Preventive Services Task Force, the American Cancer Society, the American Journal of Gynecology every year, unless a woman has female problems like pelvic pain or irregular bleeding. So what does the United States Preventive Services Task Force recommend?
Well, to everybody's surprise, you know, a lot of things in medicine are done by proclamation. Somebody thinks it's a good idea and they happen to be an important, respected doctor. Everybody says, yes, let's do that. But the United States Preventive Services Task Force and these other organizations are saying, you don't need an annual pap smear starting at age 18. You can start at age 21 and do it through age 65 every 3 years as a preventive screening, and maybe only every 5 years if you had a previous pap smear and also a negative HPV test. So it's not even necessary for women over the age of 65 if they've been normal up to that time.
Hallelujah.
Yeah, isn't that something really?
And you know what else is that Medicare only covers you've seen the gynecologist every 2 years, but a doctor may recommend the test more often. And
well, they do. I mean, a lot of them do. And a lot of it's because it's a conflict of interest. It's because it makes more business, too. I know your OBGYN wanted you to do them every year. And I sent her some information and said, well, you know, not everybody agrees with that. And there's nothing wrong with Vicki. So why are we doing this every year? And her point was, well, I just feel better doing it. And I understand that because that's what we're taught in medical school and in our residencies and postgraduate training, is that you must do a pelvic on a woman once a year, just like you must do a rectal exam on a male patient every year as well. And it turns out, that's not the case for either.
And a lot of times the patient expects it. They think that they're supposed to. I've known people that have had hysterectomies and maybe had their ovaries removed also.
And they're still
getting. And they go in for a pap smear? Wait, you can't even do a pap smear when you've had a hysterectomy,
well, that's true.
Can you?
And what they say is they're screening for ovarian cancer, but, you know, there's an ovary there. So what's it all about?
Also, do these tests detect ovarian cancer?
Well, they don't. I mean, it's a very poor test for screening for ovarian cancer. There really aren't any good tests to do that that are cost-effective. You're really going to have to do a couple of tests. One might be that you're going to do an ultrasound periodically, or maybe check for a calcium 125, which is a blood test that screens for it. But by that time, usually the horse is out of the barn and it's too late. But I think the biggest thing here is, this is a private invasive procedure.
Well, and I'll say.
Yeah, and I think maybe only women should do it. And I'm not so sure it's a good idea that men do it. And I'll tell you why.
I mean, I can give you an example, too.
Well, I know you can.
Well, years ago when I was a young nurse, I was having some visual disturbances that turned out to be symptoms of a vascular migraine. And I didn't know what it was, but my vision was messed up. And so I mentioned it to a couple of the nurses on the floor, and a doctor came by, and
to the rescue.
Yeah, and he happened to be a gynecologist.
So you know what he's going
to
do.
And he wanted to do a pelvic. And it was like, no, thank you. Why? Right. You know, but see, that's because that's what he does. And then this other doctor came by, and he was a GI specialist. He wanted to do a colonoscopy. It's like, what do these things have to do with
my head's up here on the top,
with
Doc.
My eyes and my head, yeah.
Well, I mean, look at how many women have had sexual abuse and have post-traumatic stress. And usually it's from a man. Do you think that's a good idea for another man, even though he may be the most wonderful man in the world, to try and provoke those old triggers that led to the PTSD? I think not. So I think that when we're looking at some of the screens that we do, they're done by proclamation, not by common sense or by science. I mean, look at the mammograms under age 50 and colonoscopies and pap smears and chest x-rays and EKGs that are all done as screens in people who have no symptoms at all.
Well,
not
also,
the right thing to do.
Okay. Also earlier, you just barely touched on HPV. Mm-hmm. That's the human papilloma virus.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people are, you know, wondering if they should get their teenagers vaccinated, you know, with Gardasil and so forth. But because now these new guidelines say only every 5 years do you need to have a pelvic exam if you had a previous pap with an HPV that was negative.
Right.
And also, I think people need to know that HPV often clears on its own.
Yeah, by age 30, a lot of people have had it, and it's okay.
So maybe you don't even need to start getting pap smears till you're 30.
Well, you know, if you have a doctor that's got good common sense and knows you well, I think you would do a pap smear when it seems like the right time. Yep. I don't think you need to start in everybody at age 18 or at age 21 or 25. I think it should be something that is really just negotiated and see how the patient feels about it. And it may be that they want that because it will make them feel like they're okay. Maybe they're thinking about getting married and they want to be sure they're okay. A lot of reasons why it could be flexible, and sometimes maybe it's necessary to do it with somebody who's under 18.
But I thought it was interesting that this article and study shows that this has been done without a scientific basis.
Well,
it's just
right.
been a traditional thing to do.
Well, when you talk to doctors, I mean, 87% of the physicians that were screened for this thought that people should be having their first pelvic exam at age 18. And, you know, a lot of these things are just like that. So we need to take more time to think about what's the right thing to do, just jump into it because there's been a policy somewhere. All right, you're listening to Prescriptions for Health. I'm Dr. Len Saputo here with Nurse Vicki, and we'll be back after a short Prescriptions for Health break and Nurse Vicki's final 2020 tip on food for thought. And when we come back, we'll be talking about how profound are medical school conflicts of interest and do oncologists make a profit on the chemotherapy they prescribe? Stay tuned.
Important to notice where our food comes from. I mean, you'd be surprised at how much of our food is from China, where their standards aren't as good as they could be, and some is even grown in, get this now, human feces.
Oh, jeez.
Like garlic, for example. Now, unless it's clearly marked from the USA or Canada, it's best not to buy it. And remember, China is the largest producer of garlic in the world, and the US is next. So why buy garlic grown in people poop from China when we have healthy grown garlic in the U.S.?
Right.
And we always recommend organic garlic, of course. And as far as produce goes, if the country of origin isn't shown on the item in the store, a good rule is to either just not even buy it or go to the local farmer's market when it's in season.
Oh, that's definitely a good way to go.
Now, I just want to expose a few brands here while I'm at this. Green Giant frozen vegetables are from China, and so are most of the, Europe's best. Now, Arctic Gardens in Canada is an okay brand. Just beware of anything from China, even toys and jewelry.
Right.
And the popular Canadian supplement, Cold Fix, it's written down as cold with a dash and a capital FX. It's said to ward off infection because the active ingredient, which is ginseng, helps to activate your natural killer cells and other components of your immune system. But beware of where it was made because it has been reported that if it's made in China, it can also contain fecal bacteria. And if the country of origin's not clearly marked, either ask or hold off. So watch out for packages that state prepared for, packed by, or imported by. Now, how is it possible to ship food from Canada cheaper than having it produced in the U.S. or Canada? For example, the Our Family brand of the Mandarin oranges says right on the can, from China. So for a few more cents, just buy the Liberty brand. Cold brand or the Dole from California is from California. But beware, Costco sells canned peaches and pears in a plastic jar that come from China. And all Highliner and most other frozen fish products that come from China or Indonesia. And the package may say Pacific salmon on the front, but look for the small print. Because most of these products come from fish farms in the Orient where there are no regulations on what's fed to these fish. Now, recently in the Montreal Gazette, they had an article by the Canadian government on how Chinese feed the fish. Now, listen to this one. They suspend chicken wire crates over the fish ponds, and the fish feed on the chicken mess.
Oh, jeez.
And if you search the internet about what the Chinese feed their fish, you'll be alarmed, like growth hormones and expired antibiotics from humans. So never buy any type of fish or shellfish that come from Vietnam, China, or the Philippines. And now we have to be concerned about the FDA approving frankenfish.
That's,
you know,
right.
That's the DNA of salmon with growth hormone from this eel-like creature called an ocean pout. And the fish grow twice as fast, and then they'll affect our wild salmon population. And there's no GMO labeling. We just voted that out. So we can't even avoid it. And if you want to do something about this, you can go to organicconsumers.org and just sign the petition I did. So biotech is making a lot of money on this. So Chinese export inferior and toxic products, and check the bottoms of the products. And if it says made in China or PRC, choose another one, another product, or just skip it altogether.
Wow, powerful stuff. Thank you, Vicki.
Yeah, things to be aware of. We have to take responsibility for ourselves and not just count on the government to not import things like that. Okay,
right.
So change takes time, and medical schools are finally catching on to conflicts of interest. Or are they? Well, Big Pharma's influence on medical students is pretty big.
I'll say.
And they're making significant strides to reduce the influence of pharmaceutical companies, like with free drug samples and interaction with sales reps and industry-funded education and promotional speaking and restricting gifts and meals offered by Big Pharma. But what are they leaving out?
Well, the research is certainly the biggest part there. And, of course, when I was in medical school and in my internship and residency, these drug reps were all over the place. And they were taking us out to go hunting or to do things that cost a lot of money and giving us meals and trying to buddy-buddy us. And of course, what we did is we prescribed what was written on our pen. It might have been, you know, Mevacor at the time or whatever it was.
That was your cheat sheet.
Well, because we didn't know that much, and the influence that we had from those people was huge. So the American Medical Student Association formed a farm-free scorecard, and they have about 11 different areas of conflict, and they found that about 105 of 152 medical schools were getting grades that were, according to them, much better than they were a few years ago, at which time the majority of schools were getting D's, F's, or incomplete. So there's a lot happening that's really coming from the medical students themselves, as they're becoming aware of the problems that we have because of the conflicts of interest that the pharmaceutical industry has.
You know, another biggie is the disclosure of the conflicts of interest by the physicians that are leading the rounds.
Well, when one of your mentors says, "I like this drug for that problem," that's certainly a way to market things to students. And even that, you know, because a lot of these people have conflicts of interest themselves because they're doing research that might be sponsored from that company. So I think the best thing to do is to sever the ties that we have with the pharmaceutical industry in our medical schools. And there are only two medical schools that got a perfect score on this test that the American Medical Student Association gives. One was the University of South Dakota, and the other was Florida State College of Medicine. So we have a lot of room for improvement there. And really only...
Yes, we do. But it's also good news for the future of doctors and their patients, because the first step is awareness.
Absolutely.
You know, and so now they're aware of it and they're doing something about it. But it's hard for them to do it all the way, I guess, as far as the research goes.
I think if you want to learn about the karma of Big Pharma, which is a title of one of the chapters in my book, A Return to Healing, highly recommend that you get the book and learn about what kinds of things are happening that are conflicts of interest that are induced by the pharmaceutical industry. And of course, that's just one chapter of the book, A Return to Healing. You can get it on Amazon or on the website at drsabuda.com at actually a better price. So we have some work to do to change that. And I think that you have to look at the pharmaceutical industry as a business. They're not really trying to do charity. What they're doing, particularly when they're giving free samples, is they're giving starter kits. And what? For their most expensive drugs. And then, of course, they're trying to push the drugs that patients use for the longest times, like the antidepressants, or people are using things for hypertension. Once they get you hooked on that, then you feel like you're really kind of stuck. And then what do you do to really try and change things? It's not so easy, because people get attached to certain things. The other thing is, of course, there are a lot of physicians who work with pharmaceutical companies and will give talks. Why? Because they get as much as $10,000 to give one-hour talk. And if they're giving that talk to medical students or doctors, what better advertising is there? So,
pretty hard for the doctor to turn that down.
Well, I've never agreed to do that and never would, because I agree with you, but that does happen. And, of course, if you're going to get $10,000 or more for a talk, chances are you're going to say the message that the drug company wants you to say. Very interesting that it's that way. So,
well, that's how they get movie stars to advertise for different drugs and stuff,
oh,
too.
Oh, sure.
They pay them a ton of money.
Look at Sally Fields talking about Boniva. She should stick to acting. Rather than,
well, she is.
Well,
that's
what
she's
doing there. You're exactly right. I should have figured that out.
Okay. You know, most cancer patients, they just love their oncologists, and they have a
exactly.
close relationship, and they feel that they work together. But would you still love your cancer doctor if you knew that they had conflicts of interest in prescribing chemotherapy and growth factor drugs, like these hormonal drugs that regulate blood cell growth, the Procrit and the Epigen? I mean, most oncologists give these treatments in their offices, and many get kickbacks from the pharmaceutical companies.
Oh, they
so
do. When they do that,
that's big money for using their chemotherapy drugs.
Oh, no question. It's one of the worst conflicts of interest in medicine. And now the doctors themselves did a project that was published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology that looked at that and asked doctors if they thought that influenced their income. Well, it's like, duh. I mean, if you make up to 65% of your income in your office from the sale of pharmaceutical drugs, wow, you think you might just have a little bit of conflict of interest there that would tempt you to use the more expensive drug than the least one?
I don't think
that
they
should even.
Or to
use it when it's borderline?
They shouldn't even allow it. You know, there was something else that was showing how doctors in private practice admit that they're 9 times more likely to make more money if they administer chemo themselves compared to hospital doctors.
Oh, sure. And there were some that denied that it would even change their income, but we know that's baloney. I mean, when you're talking about making, say, on an average, 25 or 30% of your income coming from drugs, something's wrong.
Well, this article says 65% of the oncologist's
income. It says up
income.
To 65%. That's right. I think the average is more like 25 or 30. And then you look at one of the examples of a clinic in the Pacific Northwest a few years ago that was prescribing drugs that were used to increase blood components, you know, when your blood count drops because of the chemotherapy or the cancer itself. There was one group up there of 6 oncologists that made $2.7 million in rebates from the company that made millions on it. In fact, it was the leading seller of all drugs in Medicare, and it came to billions of dollars of income. Those doctors made an average of almost $500,000 each per year for the sale of just that class of drugs. You can imagine how much money was made when you look at all the other chemotherapy drugs that were out there and other things that were sold.
See, it just seems like that shouldn't be allowed and that they should get in trouble for that.
Well, they should, and it hasn't happened, but at least it's getting into the publication so that we're starting to know about that.
And if people want to know more about that, you write about that in your book, A Return to Healing. In fact, that particular one is on page 126.
Okay, it's in the book. Yeah, for sure. So this,
nobody really wants to hear this, you know, because they like their oncologists and people that have cancer. I mean, they're vulnerable and to think they're being taken advantage of like this.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really a shame. I mean, you know what happened is that the U.S. government tried to reduce the profit margin from administering chemotherapy. But then what happened is that the doctors just prescribed more profitable drugs.
Yeah, sure. That's the way it works.
So that didn't make a difference when the government tried to get involved in it.
Well, in my opinion, the field of oncology is one of the most conflicted of interest fields in medicine. When you've got a system that's limited, that only looks at the kinds of things that are reported in the medical mainstream literature as the approach for treating cancer, you're leaving out all these other things that are possible to use that are in cutting-edge medicine that we call complementary and alternative medicine. And some of them have been around for a while that are drugs that are inexpensive, that probably work, but we don't have studies from the National Institutes of Health because it, too, is involved with this collaboration that's got conflicts of interest, so they don't do the studies that often on them. So it's.
But there are tons of other choices. You know, we have some of them on our fast track editions on our website, drsaputo.com.
No, there are a lot of.
Like.
Artemisinin and methyljasminate and IV vitamin C. And
rice bran.
Even rice bran. There are a lot of simple, inexpensive things. And our doctors, our oncologists, absolutely should be familiar with these approaches because it's part of their responsibility.
But they're not
going to
make any money off of it. Well, see, that's the conflict of
interest. Not only that, they all stick together and gang up and say, well, we just do science-based medicine. Well, baloney on that. If there's any science that's really poor, it's in the field of oncology where they're comparing one drug to another, and hardly ever have I seen. In fact, I can't remember a single study where they looked at one treatment and compared that to controls that didn't get treatment. It's sort of like the vaccine industry says, well, we can't ethically do that.
Because they assume that you need it.
Yeah, well, you look at some of the drugs that are out there that don't extend life, that may improve quality of life a little, that you may spend $10,000 or $15,000 a month.
Most of them don't improve your quality of life. Most of them make you sicker.
Well, that's true. That's true.
Make you feel terrible.
Well, okay, so we need to clean that whole field up. In fact, we have to clean the field of medicine up. When we've got these conflicts of interest that we're talking about, where so many of the chiefs of the departments of various parts of medical schools are actually employed by or getting grants from or getting something from the pharmaceutical industry, we're no longer doing science. What we're doing is business and trying to do the best that we can in that setting. But when our livelihood, you know, our income that we're used to live our lives is affected, this is what happens. I mean, that's just a no-brainer. So we've got to change that. And I think the doctors have to come to the rescue. Now, just see what happens as soon as we have medicine that's more socialized. Not that I'm opposed to universal health care. I'm not. But what I am opposed to is a system that is where one size fits all and where we have a system that is just doing one kind of thing as far as a treatment is concerned for each illness.
Well, they're so closed-minded.
Well, yes, but there's lots of conflicts of interest that have to do with deals behind the scenes that don't just affect the doctors. I mean, it affects Congress. I mean, Congress has been bought multiple times by the pharmaceutical and the insurance industry. So our whole system needs to be changed. We need to become more responsible, more open-minded, more interested in service rather than in economics, which is what medicine's all about these days. And we haven't changed it. We're still stuck in that same paradigm. And so thank God for these students, okay,
well,
who are coming to the rescue.
Yeah. Well, I don't think that these oncologists are bad.
No, they're
bad
human.
People. And I don't think that they're really unethical. I think a lot of times
that is unethical.
I think they have this conflict of interest, and I don't think sometimes they even get what they're doing.
Well, they do at a deeper level. I mean, look at the screening tests that used to be done. A chest x-ray every year, an EKG in every patient as they approach 40, doing a pap smear every year, doing a colonoscopy at age. I mean, all these things are business deals. And who's supporting them? The people who are in those particular fields of medicine. So you have the gastroenterologist saying, oh, yes, you have to have this test for colonoscopy. And the OBGYN saying, yeah, you got to have a pap smear every year. And the urologist saying, yeah, you got to check the prostate. I mean, hello. there's a place for common sense where you do the right thing.
If you go to a surgeon, expect you're going to get surgery.
Well, you might. Well, it's like going to the butcher shop and ordering broccoli. It's not going to happen. I mean, we don't recommend that. But we got some stuff here. We got some nice farm fresh salmon for you that's GMO'd.
Might be eating chicken poop.
Yeah, that's right. So we need to become more evolved as human beings, more concerned about what we're doing, more interested in what our epitaph will say when this life is done. Have I done the best I could do? Did I add something to the culture? Or was I just narcissistic at the expense of the rest of humanity? And very few people can say that, because that's what happens so often in life. So until we make that change, and everybody wants to be that way and inspired to do it, we're in big trouble as a culture.
And having a goal of being the best person that you can be.
Indeed, Vicki. We also know that oncologists are good people, and they want to do the right thing.
And they believe that what they're doing is the right thing, you know, even if there is a conflict of interest.
Well, and there's some things that they do that save a lot of lives. I mean, look at the leukemias and lymphomas. They do magical things.
Chemo works for that.
It works for a lot of things if it's used thoughtfully. It's just what we're talking about here is we don't really want to get into necessarily the expensive drugs or be treating people who are not going to benefit much from it and saying, well, it's the only thing that there is. And we certainly don't want to leave out the complementary and alternative things that are on the cutting edge.
Well, this is why so many people take trips to other countries, because
exactly.
In our country, in the United States, it's not really accepted to do alternatives. So people go to Mexico and the Bahamas and to Germany for a lot of these alternatives. I mean, it even goes so far as to do coffee enemas and
well,
juicing
don't
with
scoff
vegetables.
At them. That's right. That's right. I mean, what we do is fine, but there are other things to do as well. There's no medical freedom in this country. We don't have the right to choose the therapies we want if they're not allowed by the medical boards.
I know. It's really sad when children can be taken away from their parents because the parents don't want
to
do mainstream medicine for their children that have cancer.
And that's so, even for some kids that don't do very well with the treatment. It's amazing at the laws and how they have to change. We need to lobby for a new amendment in the Constitution to give people the right to choose the treatments they want.
And then what about Dr. Stanislaw Brzezinski in Texas? And he does these anti-neoplastic therapies.
Neoplastins
therapy, mm-hmm. particularly for brain tumors.
Kids that have brain tumors. It works for a lot of other tumors as well.
But he was given a really bad time.
Well, his story is on the internet, and if you put his name in the internet, it's probably...
How do you spell it?
Brzinsky. S-K-I. Interesting guy. So what we have here is something that needs to change. We need to get access to doctors who know the kinds of therapies that are in all phases of medicine, not just the oncologist.
Well, I think it's good for people to not rush their treatment. You know, so many times we've heard that you get a diagnosis of cancer, you need to do something right now. I mean, you need to do it yesterday.
Yeah, right.
And it's okay to take a little bit of time. You know, you can go online and research it a little bit and your doctor some intelligent questions. What would be some good questions to ask your doctor before considering having chemotherapy done?
Well, it certainly would depend on your situation, but in general, I'd say, if I do the therapy, how long do you think I'll live? If I don't do the therapy, how long do you think I'll live? And do you have data to show this?
And what would be my quality of life?
Absolutely. I mean, what will this do to me? How will I suffer? What does it cost? Lots of factors like that. And you've got to pin down the oncologist so that you get honest answers and you know that what the situation is so you can make an intelligent decision.
You know, earlier we talked about some of the alternatives like the methyl jasminate and the artemisinin and the IV vitamin C and so forth. But our metabolic terrain is really important. Our environmental toxins, not eating a lot of sugar, our lifestyle, living a healthy lifestyle. We say this over and over and over again, but we really need to get this point across so people will pay attention to it. Getting our exercise, eating a healthy diet, you know, getting enough sleep, reducing our stress, having a reason to get up in the morning, giving ourselves a meaningful purpose in life. all these things are so important to slow it down and maybe even get rid of it. You know, it's there true. Are some cancers that just go away on their own.
They do. I mean, look at breast cancers. If you do autopsies on women who are 50 years old who have died from traffic accidents or something remote, about 30% of them have a cancer in the breast. It's an invasive cancer. But 30% of women aren't dying from that. These cancers come and go. And if you do something to make your body strong so that it can defend against these cancers, it makes a big difference. Anyway, we're at the end of the show here, Vicki. I'd like to remind you that we'll be back to talk about what's new in the news and health every Monday morning on PRN.FM and drsaputo.com from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern Time and 7 to 8 a.m. Pacific Time. Prescriptions for Health will also be available 24/7 on drsaputo.com as well as PRN.FM.
And if you enjoyed today's show and you'd like to have more information on the topics we discussed, go to Dr. Saputo Radio on drsaputo.com and check out our Fast Track videos. And remember, a healthy lifestyle is the most powerful healer in the universe. So if you want to be well, pay attention to the style in which you live your life.
We'll see you next time.